of West Virginia and daughter of United States Senator Charles Percy. But because of the pressing campaign that is going on in the state of Illinois, she has been forced to be elsewhere this evening, and we certainly understand that. And she has given us a rain check, and the next time she comes back in the city of Chicago, she has agreed to join us. We were going to talk with her not only about her life in politics, but also about her involvement in the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, of which she is a member of the CPR board. Our guest this evening is David Duke. And for those of you who are not familiar with the name David Duke, he is the Grand Wizard of the Knights of the Ku Klux Klan. And on the program this evening, we will be talking about racism in the United States of America, what causes it, and to what extent is the Ku Klux Klan speaking to many in our society who are looking for some way to vent their spleen, to get the frustration of everyday life off their chest. Mr. Duke, thank you very much for joining us. We should mention that earlier today you appeared on a television program and there was some problems vis-a-vis some violence. Are you feeling all right this evening?
I'm feeling okay. My back might be a little sore, but I'm feeling fine. I'm glad to be here and glad to be able to talk to many of the people of Chicago and let them know what the Klan is from our own lips instead of the Hollywood versions that are put out in America.
Okay. Before we get into the specifics of the Klan and what they are up to, I would like to find out a little bit more about David Duke. And in looking over an article, I see that you're 28 years of age, you're married, you're a father of one child, you're a graduate of Louisiana State University, you are an outstanding ROTC cadet. You attempted to go to Vietnam, but the U.S. Army rejected you, according to the article that I read, because they found out that you were a racist. How did they find out you were a racist?
Well, basically, I was in the ROTC program at LSU, and I had an excellent record there at LSU in ROTC. I had the highest rank of any basic cadet in the second-year program. I was recommended by both my officers in the drill field and that in the classroom as an outstanding student. And when it came time to go advanced, I was approved by a three-man officer board, but the professor of military science, under a great deal of political pressure, told me that I could not go advanced and get my commission because I was a racist. And even in spite of the fact that I performed well on the field with whites and blacks, there had not been one instance of any sort of wrong treatment.
Firsthand, what the Klan is all about and not be swayed by Hollywood or what they have read in the newspapers. First of all, let's talk about the impression of the Klan as it exists in most people's minds. They hate blacks, they hate Jews, they hate Catholics, they burn crosses. They have secret meetings. They walk around with sheets on their heads when they have their little claverns. And it's an organization built on hatred. Where is that impression wrong?
Well, I think it's wrong pretty much all the way down the line. I'm not in this thing because I hate anybody. I'm in this thing because I love my own race, my traditions, my culture, that of Western civilization, our art, architecture, science, system of government, democratic government, system of justice, and I love my own people too. I love the characteristics of our race, the beauty of our people, and I want to preserve that. I think that it's a unique people. I think that all peoples should have the right to preserve their own cultural and racial integrity. I think that most races of the earth want to do that. It's only the white race that seems to be prevented or being are put down because of that kind of feeling. I watch television, well, quite seldom, really, but when I watch it, I see some things that are quite interesting to me. I've seen a lot of cartoons or commercials about conservation, about endangered species that exist, about the cougar and the Rocky Mountains or the whale in the Pacific. And they say to the American people, it would be a tragedy if these animals were lost. That is their uniqueness, their unique species, breed, we lost to this earth. We would lose something. But at the same time, the government seems to be pushing programs of forced integration. The media constantly pushes, I think, race mixing, interracial mixture, like Guess Who's Coming to Dinner, and I guess a million other programs like that. We have forced busing. We've got forced integration in so many sections of our society. And you know, I just think that's inconsistent. I think that we should have a right to maintain our culture and our integrity. Now, as for the Klan, The first thing I would say to people is that I would ask them, they might think that I'm going to say something quite strange for a Klansman to say, but I'm going to ask them to not be prejudiced in this manner. And prejudice truly means to prejudge something. That's where its roots are, to prejudge. And I don't think that I am prejudiced. I've read both sides of the racial issue and both sides of the subject on the Ku Klux Klan, books both pro and against, articles both pro and against.
When you meet, when people join the Klan, and I want to find out exactly what that means, polls this evening.
Yeah.
To what extent are people joining because they are proud to be white, as opposed to the people who are joining because they hate blacks, Jews, or Catholics?
I think most of the people are getting involved because they are proud to be white and love their own race. I think that there is certainly a degree of resentment about what's happening in our communities, the tremendous amounts of minority crime. There's resentment about the discrimination that's going on across the board against white people in employment, scholarships, promotions.
Do you concern yourself when you talk about crime? Do you concern yourself in any way with the causes of crime or just the way that those causes can manifest in themselves?
Yeah, we're definitely concerned about it, and I'd like to say other than one thing, too, before I get into that. By the way, the Klan is not anti-Catholic. In fact, there was at one time a Klan group that was somewhat anti-papal. At the same time in Louisiana, for instance, there was a group called the Knights of the White Camellia, which was made up of all Catholics who kind of discriminated against Protestants, who kept to their own.
So you let Catholics into the KKK?
Oh, absolutely. And in fact, our grand chaplain of the organization is himself a Catholic, and that's the top religious officer, advisor to our members. The original Klan under Nathan Bedford Forrest, in fact, had many Catholics who participated in the Klan. There was a Klan, as I said, in the 1920s that was somewhat anti-Catholic, but this is... I don't like the National Council of Churches. I don't like money going into the collection plate and some of it finding its way to finance the Patriotic Front or the Black Guerrillas in Rhodesia and South Africa, who are murdering Christians, both black and white. I just can't see that. But the National Council of Churches and the World Council of Churches has given money to communist, atheist terrorists who've come in and murdered people. Good examples in Rhodesia, where these same communist group came in and killed a dozen missionaries and their children, 3, 4, 5 year old children and the adults, and brutally mutilated them and butchered them.
What is your personal feeling right now? Because again, you've spoken, your feelings about the white race now. What is your feeling specifically about blacks and about Jews point in time?
My feeling is that I think they should have the same right to pursue their culture, their ideals, their interests that the white people have. I think if I was a black, I'd be proud of my race. I'd want my children to look something like me and the people that came before me. I'd love my own people. I'd try to work for a society that would reflect the ideals of my people. A community that would reflect the ideals of my people.
Should they have a right to live where they choose?
I think so, but I think that all people should have that right. In other words, I think forced integration is not doing anybody any good. Integration, as it started out, as it was told to the American people, was going to be that busing and forced integration has not raised black scores appreciably. In fact, in many cases, it has lowered them. There's been tremendous amounts of violence in our public schools. Last year I was saying that there are 400,000 serious assaults in our public schools by NEA figures. Then about 3 months ago, the United States Congress did a study, and they revealed that there are approximately 200,000 serious assaults happening in our public schools every month. And it's a tremendous number. And these assaults can be almost directly correlated with the amounts of integration. The more integrated the school systems are, the more integration they experience, the more violence they've had. Integration, I believe, is a total colossal failure. Now, the answer to it, I don't think, is some sort of repressive or tyrannical program. The answer is simply giving people a choice, I think. Most blacks want to be among black people. I think by far most whites want to be among their own people also, including the young people. And by the way, young people, a lot of people have blamed the failure of integration, the fact that their parents are teaching young people wrong. That's not true. The parents today have a very slight influence on their child as compared to schools, as compared to 22,000 hours of television a child watches about until he's 18 years old. And almost all the literature he reads, the magazines he reads, the movies he watches, the television programs he watches, all encourage integration, all encourage racial mixture. And but anyway, getting back to the point, I guess.
I want to follow up on your most recent comment, however, mm-hmm. and that is the influence of parents over young people.
Yeah.
To what extent did your parents influence you?
Well, very little as far as the racial matters are concerned.
Where'd that come from?
Well, to tell you the truth, it came from, it started with a book called Race and Reason, A Yankee View.
How old were you when you read it?
I'd say about 13, and just turning 13. I'd already read a lot before then. I've been an avid reader since I was very young. But in fact, I'd say in many ways I was becoming somewhat liberal in my attitudes. I think that if you watch television and you read a lot and you read newspapers and magazines and books today, that you will become liberal, especially on the racial issue. My parents, by the way, were not originally from the South, or one you might say was from Missouri. My father was from Kansas. I had relatives, forefathers that fought on both sides of the Civil War, or the war between the states, and they did not inculcate any racial prejudice, and I don't believe I'm racially prejudiced today. You know, I believe that there are racial differences, but I don't think that's prejudice. Again, that's to prejudge something. That's not to weigh the evidence.
Much of what you have said this evening, with the exception of comments that you have made that could be construed as anti-Semitic or blatantly anti-black, and you've been, even in that area, you've been relatively calm thus far in the program.
I try to be calm as much as I can.
What you are saying has been said and is said frequently by people who would describe themselves as to the right of center or conservatives or whatever term that you might want to put to it. In other words, these are some of the gripes that you hear in the steel mills, that you hear in the white collar areas, that you hear maybe in the suburbs, that you hear in any area in the city of Chicago, let's say a racially changing area.
But it's almost never articulated by any political leaders. It's never articulated, and no movies ever pose this type of an attitude,
right,
or this type of an idea.
My question to you, David, is this.
Yes.
The way you talk and the way that you say it, it would seem to me that if you chose to go into the political arena, you might get a following. You might get a large following. You may not be president, but I would think that there were certain areas of this country where you could be maybe a congressman, maybe a state senator. You ran for the state senate in Louisiana, I realize, and you lost several years ago. My question to you is, why did you decide to embrace the Ku Klux Klan and all the negative images that means to wear as an albatross around your neck for the rest of your life? Why didn't you join some other party? Why didn't you make up a name of an organization and start it and say that you're the president of it? Why the Klan?
Well, maybe it's because I'm too honest. Maybe it's because the problem with white people today is that we're too willing to compromise our beliefs, our ideals, our principles. Maybe
But you did say earlier that you know, the old traditions of the Klan, you know, the anti-Catholicism is something that you don't necessarily really agree
with. What I said was the original Klan was not anti-Catholic. And there's been a lot of Klan groups over the years.
Do you enjoy going around in white sheets? How, you're not dressed in a white sheet this evening, this afternoon, when I met you for the first time.
It's not my usual wardrobe, I can tell you that.
When do you put your white sheet on?
Well, as only the most times that I'm under the sheets is when I'm in bed, to tell you the truth. But I wear them for ceremonies. They're not sheets, by the way. They're robes. You know, you could do the same thing and call Catholic priests. You know, what's the kind of media word again? A kind of a derogatory word in the Klan. I wear the robes at ceremonies and in the fraternal ceremonies of our organization. We have what we call cross lighting ceremonies, and which is a very positive thing. It's not a desecration of the cross. It never has been. It's an ancient Christian symbol. And by the way, about the robes, very few people even know about, even understand about the robe's origin. You know, a lot of people can go to South America or to Europe today, and they'll see these people in these white peaked hoods, you know, covering their face in these long white robes, and they're carrying Christian statues and ornaments and Christian motifs through the street. And people, if people didn't know any better, they'd say, well, these are clans people. Well, what it is an ancient Christian ritual whose origin means anonymity and doing good work. And that's originally where the robes came from. It is true that during the Reconstruction period, they were used to hide the identity of people from a very tyrannical government in the South, where white people could not vote, that is, the bulk of the white population could not vote, where white people were drawn before a military tribunal, many times not even allowed jury trials, when they were terrorized by, you know, the black population at that time and the very corrupt carpetbag governments. But essentially, this is the original meaning of the Robin Hood, and this is the meaning that it holds for the organization. Not, and that's quite contrary to the Hollywood image, I'm sure.
How often does one appear in the robe at a Klan gathering? And what would cause... do they still refer to them as... are they Claverns, or is it Clavern?
Well, they're called dens, actually.
Dens, okay. How often do you get together and have meetings where you would be in robe?
Well, most Klan dens have a meeting once a month in terms of an active business meeting. They also have...
What do you talk about? What business comes up from month to month?
Well, like getting out more literature, people they've talked to, people they've recruited, activities that may be, you know, in a social welfare standpoint from the white... for the white people, activities trying to work to secure the civil rights of whites who are being discriminated, for instance, in jobs or employment.
How do you
It
do
might
that?
Even be, well, there's lots of ways. Like in schools, a lot of times the principals and school administrators are afraid to even discipline blacks when they're doing wrong things against white children and other blacks, because they're afraid the NAACP is going to come in and they're going to be called racist, they're going to be called prejudiced or something. And often white children really suffer at the hands of these some of these blacks in some of these schools. And often the Klan, we can go to the school board and we can represent these white students and stand up for them and their rights. I know in the South many times they tried to change the names of schools, for instance, from old Southern leaders to names like Martin Luther King, and the students didn't like this, and we were the only organization willing to stand up for them.
To what extent are you actively trying to broaden your base in the urban high schools of the United States, especially in those areas where, as you said earlier in the program, there has been a history of racial turmoil?
Well, I think you know, it's not been really that much of an effort on our part. It's just come naturally. The young person today is probably, I think, the most racist generation, and I mean racist as racial conscious generation of any generations of Americans than perhaps since the war between the states, because they're experiencing integration and they see with their own eyes that it doesn't work. They see with their own eyes the distinct cultural, racial, physical, genetic differences between white and black, and they don't like it. And integration has been the greatest recruitment boon to the Klan than anything. Integration's recruiting members for the Klan. Not my policies, not what I'm saying, as much as what's happening in our schools these children see and experience.
But how do they get to you? I mean, how does one join the Klan?
Mostly,
I mean,
it's by word of mouth.
You don't look in the yellow pages.
Mostly it's by word of mouth. The other day, I know at Taft High School, there was a, and this was, I think, mentioned in the local papers here, they had on Halloween or whatever, a couple of white students came dressed up as ghosts, and the Negroes took them as Klansmen or something, and they started beating up on them. They attacked a number of people, including a couple of white girls. Again, this was reported in the paper. And the whites, you know, were furious about this, and the white students were, and nothing was done to these blacks. The white students protested, and about 2,000 of them, in fact, got together and chanted, you know, that we're gonna stay and we're gonna, you know, make our school right and white unity and things of this nature, and that's a lot of students, and that the word spreads very, very fast.
When you read something like that, first of all, does the Klan have a clipping service?
Well, we get clippings from all over the country. We don't employ a clipping service now.
When you get something like that,
right?
When you're having your meetings, is someone assigned, let's say, to work on the Taft High School situation, or to try to stir it up in any way, or to try to get out to the people, to contact the local people, to bring them in to be official members of the Klan?
Well, not really. The people that really do that are the local people involved. That's who.
So
really
you have a local Klan right here in Chicago?
Oh, yeah. We have a lot of people in this area.
How large is it? I know you don't give specific numbers, but give me a ballpark figure.
Well, I'll be very frank with you. It's small. It's small. It's not a tremendously large organization. I'd say small in relationship to the population, let's put it that way.
How do you
define? But it's growing.
How do you define a member of the Klan?
A person who's...
Do they pay dues?
Yeah, they pay dues.
How much?
Well, high school students, I think it's $6 a year, which doesn't even cover really the cost of the you know, the information and so forth they get in the newspaper and their card and their books and so forth.
That we they send. Get a news... I'm just writing this. They get a newspaper.
Right, a newsletter every month.
That's the Crusader?
Right. Plus
the voice of the white majority.
Right.
Okay. You used to be the editor of that, and you now write a column in here, right? You
right.
oversee everything that's in this paper.
I don't oversee everything, no, sir. But I am the publisher of the publication.
You're the publisher, but you don't oversee everything?
No, because we have an editor and he handles, I don't even see most of the issues until they're off the press.
Is it once a month?
Yes.
So they get a monthly newsletter.
Right. Well, newspaper.
And what book do they get?
Well, they get that, plus they get a membership bulletin every month. And
how does the membership bulletin differ from the newspaper?
Well, it's specifically just for members. So we have to talk about activities around the country that we're involved in and different methods of recruiting, you know, how to bring the message over to the public, the effective ways to hold Klan rallies, a little bit of philosophy we go into, what's the higher meanings of our organization, the philosophy of our movement.
Do you find that sometimes because of the way you espouse your philosophy, do you find that it sometimes sails over the head of the average student in American high schools, that maybe they don't grasp it, that maybe they need it, or they need to have it put in a much more black, white, anti-black, let's get the blacks
I put it pretty
way.
Straightforwardly, but let me say this. That's one of the things we try to do, is we try to educate the young people that come to us. A lot of them come to us very much with a very deep and abiding hatred of blacks because of what they've been through in these schools, the attacks they've been under, you know, and they've really been under some serious attacks, especially the white children in these schools that are mostly black.
When
they've
they come,
really suffered.
When they come to you.
Okay.
Again, I mean, they don't come to you physically. I want to get back to the step-by-step procedure of how someone joins the Klan.
The local person talks to them, and you know, he tries to find what their motivations are, if they would make a good member, you know, and we want quality. We don't want quantity. That's
well, how do you check
important.
Them out?
Well, the main thing is through the interview, just like a job applicant. That's really your main thing, because then you get an understanding of where the person's coming from, what his ideals are.
Where are the meetings held?
Well, the meetings are held at either homes of Klan members, or they're held, it could be even for young people, often they're just held in a park, you know, just someplace where they can meet. Nothing, no special facility or whatever is required.
And it's a word-of-mouth thing.
That's basically
that
how it goes out.
That would spread through a high school, that with, hey, there's
person
something going
person.
On, go see so-and-so, and you go see so-and-so, and he says you have to go
often
see
literature,
another guy.
Often literature accompanies it. You know, we have youth corps, what we call youth corps literature and so forth, that these young people pass out and spread out. But so they get involved, and you know, they talk to the new people that are prospective members. If they decide that they're, you know, they're good people, they're solid people, and so forth, then they'll be inducted in the organization. And then it's a process of education. And one of the main things we want to get...
Is there any induction ceremony?
Yes, there is.
What happens there?
Well, basically, it's secret. I can't tell you, you know...
Well, tell me. It's just the
I can tell you what it concerns.
Thought.
It concerns basically, by the way, every person that comes in our organization, both the old and the young, they take an oath that they will not conspire to commit an illegal act. And if they do, we'll remove them from the organization. Also, by the way, a lot of young people put out local newsletters. For instance, the local Klan here, which I forgot to mention, which a companion of mine just handed to me, the local Klan here puts out a publication called Courage, spelled with K, about the local Klan youth corps activities in the Chicago area.
What are some of the things they're up to in Chicago?
Well, again, organizing the students. One of the problems, I think, one of the reasons why I've had a lot of violence against white students is the whites have been, first of all, disorganized. They've been taught in the school classroom to feel guilty for being white. They've been told that their ancestors were exploiters and how they hurt these Negroes and so forth.
Well, that did happen in some cases, did it not?
Well, it did, but...
I mean, isn't there a degree of truth to that?
There is a degree of truth to it, but the overall, the contact between the white and black man has been much more beneficial to the black man than it's been detrimental. The black man's got medicine, and before, at one time, he had to watch his children die when they contracted the diseases. The white man's medicine, you know, helped cure these children. It came down, when you talk about freedom, justice, democracy, these are European concepts that have been spread out all over the world. When in fact, I'm not in favor of slavery in any way whatsoever, but the slavery that the Negroes were under in this country, and again, I'm not for it. But it, you know, at the same time, they had slavery in Africa. We did not go round up the Negroes. That is a myth. We bought them from other Negroes. And the slavery that they endured in Africa, where life was so cheap and things were so disorganized, so primitive, you know, was much worse than what they endured in this country. They had much more freedom under the system in this society. They had better diets. They were cared after more. They had no human sacrifices they did in Africa time after time after time. They had no cannibalism as they had practiced over most of the African continent. And slavery was not a step down for them, but it was a step up as far as the relationship with the white man. So I feel no guilt from that.
Is the only communication that goes on between Klan members done in writing, or is there some kind of a phone network if you want some instant action somewhere?
I feel like I'm before the House on American Activities Committee. Well, sure. I want to answer that on the Fifth Amendment. No. Yes, we have phone techniques. We have what you call telephone trees, which, you know, you can contact one and they contact.
It's a round robin kind of a.
Yeah, it's used by many organizations. We have that. We contact them by mail. Every member's contacted directly by mail from the national office.
What sort of things would prompt that type of action?
What type of action?
A telephone action. Let's say if you wanted quick response to something as opposed to waiting, a month for the bulletin to come out, and you wanted to get people to act quickly, and you went to the telephones, what incident would prompt you to act in that way?
Well, just like an average type of thing. Say some, for instance, Chicago a while back, had some problems in the schools. They wanted to get the, I don't know the whole incident myself. I'm not from here, as you know. But they wanted to get some action on it. They wanted to go before the school board or superintendent, I think it was, for that district. So they called up their members and so forth. They had them assemble, and they all went down to see some of the officials of the school, of the school department, of the school board here, to redress grievances of what was happening to the white students at some of these schools, some of the double standard of conduct for whites and blacks.
You are the Grand Wizard of the Knights of the Ku Klux Klan. How did you get to be the Grand Wizard?
It's an elected position. At one time, it used to be done by delegates and through appointment. And since I've been in, I've made it totally democratic in that every member of the organization votes in such an election.
And how long have you been the
For 3.5 years, I guess, almost 4 years. And but the first election that we mandated was last year. And I was elected then.
Now there are many clans. How are they intertwined?
All right. Well, first of all, they all think basically stand up for the principles of the white race. They're against the reverse discrimination going on. They're against forced busing. They're against
immigration. Well, do you speak for them as well, or do you just represent?
Not really. I can only speak for my own organization, but I.
Now, is that just in Louisiana, or I mean, you're based in Louisiana. You're from New Orleans,
right?
What clans?
Well, this organization is all over the world.
For?
The organization specifically organizes the Knights of the Ku Klux Klan, which has the oldest charter in the United States, 1956, and which is organized not only in this country, but in Canada, Australia, New Zealand, England, most of the European countries, this side of the Iron Curtain, and South Africa and Rhodesia.
Okay. We have to pause here for a moment. Our guest is David Duke, who is the Grand Wizard of the Knights of the Ku Klux Klan. We'll talk more about the structure of the KKK and turn to the telephone calls. Our phone number is 236-1531, 236-1531, if you have a question or comment about the Ku Klux Klan or a question for David Duke. Back in 60 seconds.
This is the public medium, WBEZ, Chicago.
We are back on the air, and our guest is David Duke, Grand Wizard of the Knights of the Ku Klux Klan, and we were talking about
you know, the structures. How many other people are on, like, the same level as you? The reason I ask is that a number of years ago, when the name Robert Sheldon was the name most closely associated with the Ku Klux Klan, first of all, it seemed to me that he had the title of Grand Dragon. How does Grand Dragon compare with Grand Wizard?
His title was called, I think he called it Imperial Wizard, and that was basically an offshoot of the Klan's or the ideas of some clans that were founded in the 19-teens and 20s, Joseph Simmons, that type of a clan group. Ours is based more from the original clan in terms of its purposes, ideals, standards, and I think, and its quality. He got most of the publicity. He had a great deal of activity in the 60s, especially late 50s, well, that's right, 60s, I'd say, early 60s through the 60s. And in the 70s, we've pretty much emerged. And when they talk about Klan activity in the country now, they're almost always talking about our organization, whether it be in Boston or Louisville or whether it be the
You were the Young Turks of the extreme right.
Well, I don't know about Turks. I'm white. I'm not a Turk, really. No, we're
well, you're part of the insurgent.
You're right. I'm just kidding. But yeah, we are very active. We filed court cases. We filed an amicus curiae brief, a friend of the court brief, for instance, in the Backe case. We have fought for white rights. We filed suits against Health, Education, and Welfare Department, which we call FEW instead of you. And we've also initiated Klan border watch along the Mexican-American border.
You're completely pushed the old guard aside, because I'm thinking again of the image. You know, at the beginning of the program, we talked about the ideological image of the Ku Klux Klan. You know, the cosmetic image was that, you know, the members of the KKK were fat, post 40, redneck, without teeth, and stupid.
I've still got my teeth so far, anyway. I don't know.
I mean, do you have a lot of people? I mean,
we've got
who
a lot of
in your group who look that way and act that way and have that image, or are they all?
Oh, I'm sure
young
we've got
and,
a couple.
Articulate.
Just like I think we've got a couple, just like the American Legion or the veterans of foreign wars or the Masons or whatever. But we've got a very good broad cross-section of American people now. We've got a lot of people in colleges, university campuses. We've got them in professions. And in addition, we do have people in rural areas, too, certainly.
We have
more members actually now in the North and West than we do in the South. Per capita, we're stronger in the South. But we have actual more members in the North and West now than in the South.
Do you pledge allegiance to the flag at the beginning of the Klan meetings?
That's right. Every meeting.
Sing God Bless America or
more than sing
America
God,
the Beautiful?
Sometimes we sing America Beautiful. We pledge allegiance and we say a prayer before every Klan meeting.
Do you think there is not a contradiction in saying a prayer when the goal of your organization is to eliminate blacks and Jews from certain elements of freedom in the country?
Well, I don't want to, first of all, let me say I don't want to eliminate the blacks from certain elements of freedom. That's what I'm trying to say. I tried to answer the question earlier about integration. I believe in freedom of choice. Now, I think most whites want to be with whites. I think most blacks want to be with among their own people, run their own affairs. I think there's only a small minority that wants to mix. And as far as I'm concerned, that small minority can mix. They can have all the integration they can stand. They should be allowed to. But at the same time, whites should be able to have their schools and their own communities or neighborhoods if they so desire. Blacks should be able to have theirs. And the ones that want to mix, I'm sure they can find a few others that want it, and they can have that too. What I'm talking about is the freedom to choose. The government is talking about compulsion in this matter, not me. The government is the one preventing most of the blacks and most of the whites from exercising their freedom in this matter. They're the ones depriving the white and the black people of freedom because they're not letting us choose how they want to live. So, you know, let's get that straight from the beginning.
Now, what are the goals of
as far
the
as Christianity
goes? What is the utopia that you hope to see in your lifetime?
Well, first of all, let me answer the question of Christianity too. I see Christianity becoming more and more of a social gospel taught. It's become very, very liberal, at least most of the organized churches. I know the National Council of Churches is. I mentioned earlier about the financing of communist atheist terrorists to kill Christian who were killing Christian missionaries in Southern Africa and Rhodesia. That's a good example of where our church is going today, where the Christian church is going. But I see nothing in the Bible that says that we should have integration or race mixing. In fact, the entire Old Testament is a story of a people, the Israelites, and all the way through it is admonition after admonition not to mix the blood. In fact, look, I'm not as radical as the Old Testament. I mean, in many places in the Old Testament, God calls forth the children of Israel to even massacre, I mean, commit genocide to preserve the blood. And anybody that wants to read it can check that out. Now, I don't know what God's reasons for them. I'm not going to question those reasons, but I don't believe in that. Now, as far as Christ goes, a good example is they say, some people say to me, well, you've got to, you know, you're a devil, or you've got to be anti-Christian or something because you're in the Klan and you don't believe in integration. But I just wonder, I mean, if you don't oppose segregation of the races, then you've got to be some evil or unchristian. Well, my gosh, Christ, off of that Middle Eastern area where Christ walked, there was slavery practiced everywhere. In fact, in one case, a Roman centurion had a sick slave, and he wanted Christ to heal it, and he thought that Christ could heal it from far away, and Christ did. In fact, then Christ came to visit the slave and the master, and Christ not only did not condemn slavery, and did not condemn the slave master, but in fact he said, if only all the Judeans had faith like this man. In other words, Christ never uttered a word even against slavery, and yet people are going to tell me the Bible is a social gospel that's supposed to be for integration and race mixing and all these things, and I'm sorry, I just don't see it in there. Maybe I'm just blind, but I just don't see it in there. And one other point on that is this, that God, the powerful force in this universe, nature certainly, I think, which is God's law, God created different races, and he put us on different continents, and he gave us different characteristics. And suddenly man comes along and says he's
great. Do you believe that he created them equal?
I think he created, no, of course not. He created them different. Everything in nature is different. And that's a good example.
But does different not mean equal in some cases? Can it not mean equal?
Well, I mean, I think that if somebody's around me, I think I'm going to treat a person with equal respect. But people are not specifically equal. Everybody is not the same. And I think
on the subject of respect, I would like to just jump to an issue that was very, very hot in the city of Chicago in the last year, and that was the attempt of the American Nazi Party to march into Skokie. What is your position on that issue?
Well, I think of these radical pro-race mixing and pro-civil rights Jews could go down south and march through the southern areas of the south in the 60s. I think it's kind of hypocritical of them to say that these races can't march through the Jewish areas. I just, I'm not a part of their organization. I don't agree with some of their platforms, but I do believe in freedom of speech. And I believe if you start restricting the freedom of speech of anybody, and that includes the communists or the leftists, I think they've got a right to freedom of speech too, as long as they don't start hitting people over the head. That's something else again, like they hit me this morning. They attacked me viciously when I was going into a television station to do a program. And by the way, the other people in the program were all against me, so it was even a debate. It wasn't a free forum for me. But
does that happen frequently?
Well, it's happened a number of times. The attack was very cowardly. It was from behind. Hit me in the back. I've got quite a good laceration, and I'm sure some of those creeps are probably applauding that right now, just me saying that. And I'm not applauding that. I'm not encouraging violence, and nobody
You've never encouraged violence?
Absolutely not. People, I believe in self-defense, and let's get...
What happens if somebody at a Klan meeting says, hey, let's go out and let's shoot some blacks tonight because they did something we didn't like at school today, or they were involved in a rape, or they did something, or there's nothing to do, let's go out and kill some blacks.
The minute they said something like that, I'd say, shut up or get out. That's exactly what we'd do. We would not tolerate that in our
ranks. You tolerate no violence in the Klan?
I believe that a man's got, if somebody's up here punching me in the nose, I believe you got a right to punch back and defend yourself.
Okay.
But as far as illegal acts of violence or conspiring to commit illegal acts of violence, not only I think is it wrong, but it's stupid. The government would love to use that as an excuse to destroy the whole Klan.
How many members of the Klan?
The FBI encouraged this in the 1960s, I think specifically, as Gary Thomas Rowe shows, I think specifically to discredit the Klan and destroy the Klan.
Most of the membership, or a large percentage of the membership, was paid by the government at that time.
Well, I don't know about a large,
what
but
about,
a percentage, yes.
Well, in certain areas, they said that the government was funding it and keeping it going for the very sole purpose of getting
that,
the
I'm
information.
I'm not saying that no person was involved in these things that, it wasn't sincerely a Klansman. I mean, many millions of people opposed integration and violently all
across
the
South. And they're not card-carrying members. They didn't pay their $6.
Right, but what I am saying is that the government instigated a great many of these actions specifically to discredit the Klan, to destroy it, to divide it, to lock up Klan leaders, and to try to make the Klan ineffective.
In a new book which has just been published called The Klan by journalist Patsy Sims, She speculates that David Duke just might be an agent of the federal government.
Yeah, she says that I might be a CIA agent. She's very careful not to call me a CIA agent because she knows I'd sue her. It's hard for a public figure to sue, but she knows I would.
Why would you sue her?
Because it's a lie. Because, you know, it's a way to try to discredit me among my own constituency. And it's very typical.
Well, doesn't think you're sincere.
Well, this is her argument. Her argument is that Klan's people are ignorant, dumb, fat, like you say, no good people. Just a Hollywood image. And if a guy comes along and he's halfway articulate, or he seems like a nice guy, and, you know, a lot of people said they read that book and they got an impression that she was almost fond of me. I don't know, you know. I got along fine when she was writing the book with her. Which is, as a guy that's come
was
along...
Was she the one that described you initially as the Robert Redford of the right wing?
Yeah, she used that designation.
Used that term. Okay.
But... So she says essentially that, you know, if to be a Klansman or be a racist, you've got to be hate-filled and so forth, and she didn't believe I was. So she says I must be an agent or something, and you know, I wouldn't go through what I'm going through to draw an agent's pay. I don't even draw much money at all. I mean, I really believe in this cause. I wouldn't put my life on the line.
Do you not
right.
have a job?
I'm
in your full-time job.
I write books and I write magazine articles.
Yeah, but you can't make a lot of money doing that.
Oh, sure.
You haven't had any bestsellers.
If you're good, you can.
Where do you write your articles for? Do you write them all about KKK, or do you use a pen name?
I don't write anything about KKK because they wouldn't accept or read and print my views.
You use a pen name and you write about other things?
Oh, I got to use
it. What are some of the things that you write about?
Well, I can't say specifically what my pen names have been. I've done a lot of things. I think they mentioned one book in there about a psychology book I wrote with another lady, you know. But I've done works on a lot of things, geographic articles, things of this nature.
Under an assumed name, you've had placement in, are we talking about major magazines or minor magazines?
Yes, I have.
You've been published in major magazines?
I certainly have.
And you got good pay for it?
Pretty good. You know,
what would happen if they found out who you were? Do you think they'd ever hire you?
They'd black bomb me. I'm sure. I'd have to pick up another pseudonym.
The articles that you write.
I know how the media works. I mean, it's so hypocritical.
Do they contain any of your philosophy?
Not really.
Or are they about gardening?
No, they're not about gardening. But I've had some dealing with physical sciences. I've had some dealing with, like, layman's interpretations of biological breakthroughs. I've had some dealing with just geography about a country or a society somewhere. I've done a few like that. But specifically, no, because if they reflected my ideology, no matter who I was, no matter what pseudonym you used, they wouldn't get printed. The national media is like that today. I mean, there's really a blackout of any idea that reflects race as an issue. It's a terrible situation. I mentioned this, in fact, there's such a lack of information as far as people go on the race subject. When I was in high school starting to investigate integration, when I came to believe that at least at one time, I didn't come to believe it wasn't working, but I was wondering about it, I tried to find a book that had the other point of view. They didn't have them in bookstores, didn't have them available in libraries. At first I thought, well, maybe these things were not written. Perhaps there weren't any scientists that believed integration was bad or that there were serious racial differences that would affect civilization and culture. And finally, they had a Citizens Council meeting in New Orleans, and I called up their office and asked them, do you have any books on the other side of the racial issue? And they said, sure, come on down. You know, this is after I went to Doubleday and couldn't find anything. So I got down to the office, and I was just flabbergasted because here's a whole wall of books written by scientists, educators, famous men. It was just incredible. And I read some of these books, and they made more sense than the integrationist philosophy. Well, let's look at it this way. Today, even polls have shown that a vast majority of the American people oppose busing, oppose forced integration for racial purposes. But you go in your bookstores, you can buy hundreds of books in favor of busing, in favor of integration, in favor of total racial equality. I challenge anybody listening today, go down to your major bookstores tomorrow and see what you can find on the shelves that oppose busing. Even though a great number of people are opposed to it, scientists have done studies on it, psychologists have done studies on it, vast numbers of studies. There's been tremendous amounts of work done on this thing from our point of view, in addition to the liberal point of view, but you can't get those books. And it's frightening to me.
Or you're talking about controlling manipulation of the mind, not only by the media, but you're also talking about government. Government is the people. It's made up of the people.
Oh, baloney.
Are they not reflecting are they not reflecting the basic ideals of most Americans for fair play, who believe, you know, that, you know, people should be allowed to do as they please, and regardless of their race, color, creed, or religion?
The government is totally dependent upon, I think, two things, and that's the money power in this country and the media, I mean the national media. And the national media, for instance, they can make or break anybody they want. Nixon, he committed a lot of crimes. He should have been put out of office, but he didn't commit many more crimes, and maybe less than a lot of the people that came behind him. Johnson was one of the most corrupt politicians they ever had, but the media chose not to prosecute him. Our political structure is such in this country that the more corrupt you are, I think the higher you can get. And the people that run the media and run the government know this, and they can choose to prosecute whoever they want to prosecute. And I don't believe the government is a reflection of the people at all. I would definitely contest that. White people are scared of death. Politicians, you can go up to Washington, D.C., and some politicians will say quietly, you know, if there's not too many people in the room, that, yes, we know what's happening with the race structure. We know what's happening in the schools. You know, we know what's happening with the welfare problems as far as minorities go and the majority tax money. But we can't come out openly and say that. They know what would happen to them. They'd be crucified in the press. Now, let me give you, I'm going to try and give you one concrete example.
Let me just interject something before you get to the concrete example, which everyone can relate to.
All right.
If you say that a large number of people in the United States, perhaps even the majority of the people, basically feel as you feel, that things have gone too far, why is it that a national political leader, or even a strong local political leader, who appears to be jumping onto the national horizon, why has that person not really made it? They have not emerged. The closest thing to what you're talking about was George Wallace.
Media has a tremendous power in this country. Tremendous. And so first thing, if a man comes out on the race issue, the media will attack him not only on that, but every other issue that you could possibly think of. A good example is, I remember a while back when they had one of the Nixon, I think, Supreme Court justices who he nominated, came along, and it was a right-winger. Maybe you remember this case. I can't think of the man's name right at the present time. Anyway, he was turned down by the United States Senate in confirmation, specifically because he was a right-winger or a conservative viewpoint, far, by the way, far to the left of my viewpoint. When it came time to confirm his appointment to the head of the Justice Department, which was the fellow from Massachusetts, the guy with glasses, what's his name? I'm not thinking very good today. The young fellow, they talked about a possible presidential hope. He's a Republican. I'm sorry, I can't think of his name.
He was the member of the
Republican Party. He was Attorney General for a while.
Elliot Richardson.
Elliot Richardson, that's it. Well, anyway, when he came down, time for confirmation, we found and we dug up, our people dug up a record on him that was fantastic news to the American people. That is, we found Elliot Richardson had a drunk driving record, but not only drunk driving, a long drunken driving record, but also a hit-and-run record. Like in one case, he had a hit-and-run accident. He left it. This was only about 2 or 3 years ago. This was 2 or 3 years before the confirmation hearings. He left the scene of the accident. He brought his car home, parked it in the back, and then later the police came. He lied to the police and said that he had not been out in his automobile. And later, this is all down in the police reports, you know, and this all came through, that he was a liar, he lied to the police, he had a hit-and-run accident.
But
this man was going to be our Attorney General of the United States, a top law enforcement officer of the United States.
Mm-hmm.
And this did not even get in the papers around the country. Now, I know what Anderson and so many others are columnists, and I know what the media would have done to him if he'd have been a right-winger with that kind of a record. I've seen this go on again and again and again.
But you're talking, you know, you're railing about the media, David. But you've had your share of national press coverage.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm holding a sheet right now, and I'm, here's quotes: intelligent, articulate, and charming. I mean, you've been on the Tom Snyder Show, the Lou Gordon Show. You've been on with Barbara Walters, Candice Bergen. You've had national magazine articles. You're in town now because American Broadcasting paid your way to get in here.
I mean, you're getting a pretty fair shake, and you're speaking to a lot of people. You were on television today. You're on radio tonight. This is National Public Radio, the outlet in Chicago.
Right.
This is a big station. We're 38,000 watts. You're being heard over five states right now.
Okay.
And you're saying you're not getting your fair shake to tell your story?
All right. Let me answer you very clearly and very plainly. All right. I have two answers to that. All right. One is, I never said the control was total. I never said they could control everything that went out on the air. What I've been arguing here is that the thrust of the media is against our principles, is pro-minority in many cases, pro-Zionist. I think that can be shown very, very adequately. I think that that the media is it's oriented toward that way. There's some exceptions in the media, and it's not a total control, but it's a thrust which makes it have a total impact, you might say, on the American people. Secondly, I can get, you know, I am newsworthy, and I think the organization is newsworthy, and a lot of people in media certainly have been self-serving in the fact.
I don't know if the organization is. I think you're more. You're more newsworthy than the organization.
Well, whatever.
Frankly, you know, without a membership list,
the
vague way in which you describe the mechanism of the organization. I mean, whether you got 1,000 people or 100,000.
Well, for instance, the activities all over the country. We've had activities from one corner of the country to the other: meetings, rallies, demonstrations, and so forth. But anyway.
But organizations are built around charismatic personalities, not really.
Ideology. But anyway, the second point is, I can show many instances, for instance, of this suppression in action, not only on a national level and a local level. A good example is the Tomorrow Show. And when they first invited me on there, which was almost 5 years ago, they thought they were going to get some illiterate redneck in their own image, you know, in their own Hollywood image of way a Klan person or a Klan leader is supposed to be. Once they got me on there, though, they found they had something a little bit different, and I don't think Tom Snyder was really adequately able to answer me. A lot of liberals have said that. But during the course of the show...
He really is.
Well, I don't know. He's not that dumb. He might be a little slow sometimes. But during the course of the show, he invited me back three times. He repeated it. I said, well, I don't think I'm probably going to be back here with the people in the media. He said, no. And he says, you'll be back here very soon, and we want you back here. And his last words were, Mr. Duke will be back here. And it's been 5 years I haven't been back. They invited me back a week and a half later for a program that was going to come up in January.
Let me just interject for a moment.
All right.
I was on the Tom Snyder Show.
Okay.
And he said he was going to invite me back too, on and off the air. And his producer said the same thing. And that was 4 years ago. Don't believe everything that Tom Snyder says.
Well, I'm just saying he really made a point of it to the audience to prove that I was wrong. The program got more mail practically than any other preceding it.
Well, that's what they told me too.
And it got a tremendous amount of response. Then they invited me back, and they were going to have a Jewish rabbi and a liberal leader from the Northeast, and a Negro leader, a liberal leader from Northeast, and a Negro leader from Atlanta, Georgia. I think King was his name. And they invited me back to be on the program. Then about a week later, they canceled. And they told me, the secretaries and told me, says, well, you're not going to get back on this show ever again because the people from the top passed the word down that David Duke's not going to get back on the show. And that's what they told me. And also, Joel Brinkley, who's the son of David Brinkley, did a series of articles in the Richmond newspaper. He also pointed out how the ADL and Defamation League have been putting pressure on stations and television shows to get me off the air. And he himself, in his own research, found the ADL had pressured NBC, and he felt that was the reason why I was never back on the Tomorrow Show. Another good example is Black Perspectives in the News, which was a publicly broadcast national show. I took my time out. I flew up there to Philadelphia to do the program. It was going to be interesting. It was black hosts. We had a very interesting discussion. The program was only aired in about a fourth of their stations because of the pressure and the control, again, the Jewish control, and that's what I maintain really dominates our media today. And then, finally, the program did get on, but only in a very funny version. What they did was they took an hour program. It took 10 minutes out, which they felt would be the most discreditable against me and against our organization, 10 minutes out. And then Irwin Swall of the ADL and Defamation League was on there attacking me. They watched 10 minutes of the segment, the American people, and then they spent 45 minutes attacking me. Erwin Swall, Martin Lips, another Jewish individual from who studies fascist movements or right-wing movements from California. Another Negro leader was on there, and a fellow from the liberal ACLU was on there, and they were all attacking me with that 10-minute segment. So, I mean, I've seen this control in action. I've seen programs in local areas canceled even after they were taped. I'm not using racial epithets. I don't think I'm talking in any hatred. I'm not advocating violence. But I'm saying things they don't want the American people to get. Now, I was going to give you a concrete example. Let me do that. We can, go on to your next subject.
You do your concrete example, then we're going to break, and we'll get to calls, we promise. Right. Our phone number is 236-1531. Our guest is David Duke, the Grand Wizard of the Knights of the Ku Klux Klan. Go ahead.
Are you ready?
Let's go back. It's a concrete example of what?
The suppression that's going on in this country of media of our ideas. In Washington, D.C., there's the beautiful Jefferson Memorial around the rotunda that's there in the Potomac.
Right. And it's the nicest monument in Washington.
Oh, it's magnificent. But there's Jefferson standing up, and his quotes are on the wall. And on one wall is one of his quotes, and it goes like this. He says, or it's quoted on the wall, "Nothing is more certainly written in the book of fate than that these people, in parentheses the Negroes, are to be free." There the quotation ends, and it goes in something about education. In fact, it goes on like there was no break. This quote has been repeated in literally thousands of textbooks, especially for young people, about our founding fathers, what our founding fathers' attitudes were and principles of this country. I get accused of being un-American and anti-American a lot for expressing my viewpoints. Very few people even know what the founding fathers wrote on the matter or thought on the matter. Well, anyway, this has been in thousands of editions of textbooks, it's been in novels, it's been in stories on the country, and they always quote, "Nothing's more certainly written in the book of fate than that these people, the Negroes, are to be free." But what has shocked me to a great extent is that those chiseled letters on the Jefferson Memorial are quite out of context. And they make them sound like an equalitarian, certainly, and a person before all for civil rights and race mixture and integration and so forth. But then you go to the original source, which is Thomas Jefferson's Notes in the State of Virginia, where they quote from his letter to George Washington. This was the original quote, as he originally wrote it, quote, "Nothing is more certainly written in the book of fate than that these people, the Negroes, are to be free. Nor is it less certain that these people, equally free, cannot live under the same government. Nature, opinion, and habit have drawn indelible lines of distinction between the white and black races that can never be erased." So here's a case, and there's so many textbooks that you can show an example where they use this quote, what our founding fathers completely twisted it around and left out the most important part of the quote. Another good example is Abraham Lincoln, the civil rights movement. They marched the Lincoln Memorial. Martin Luther King gave a speech with a shadow of Lincoln behind him. Lincoln said so many things, like a quote from Hart, many of his quotes. He said so many times he was not for equality, he was not for integration, he was for separation of the races, and he was shot. He was assassinated, which is the only thing that prevented him from a complete separation of the races on this continent. But this is kept from the American people. And very few people in colleges know about this, but most of the American people have no inkling of his sentiments on the race issue.
David Duke, we must pause. Our guest is David Duke, Grand Wizard of the Knights of the Ku Klux Klan. I am Bruce Dumont. It's 8 o'clock. Our telephone number is 236-1531. Our area code 312 if you reside outside the Chicago area. We'll be back in 60 seconds. We are back on the air. 236-1531 is our phone number. We're talking with the Grand Wizard of the Knights of the Ku Klux Klan. Victor, you're on the air. Go ahead, please. Good evening.
I'll have a go with you, sir.
Okay.
Yeah, I'll have a go with you, sir. Just go ahead. I'll have a go with you on that issue anytime you'd like.
He wants you to comment on it.
Okay. Well, specifically, a good example is a few days ago I was doing research on Roots, on the Roots program and Alex Haley's books. We were looking through some old Harper's, and Harper's was pretty much an anti-slavery publication. And there was an article, in fact, by a man who was very, very anti-slavery, opposed to any form, and he was going into the horrors of slavery from the standpoint of the world or worldwide. And he had an extensive article on slavery on the African continent. In fact, he mentioned a trip up the Gambia River where Alex Haley's setting was. And he said he, at every stop along the river that the steamboat came into the dock, he mentioned and he saw himself, witnessed himself, large executions of human sacrifice, 20 and 30 people at a time, slaves. In fact, the slaves in the interior of the continent, the human life was so cheap that they quite often had human sacrifice and then cannibalistic actions after it. That's just one small example. On the African continent, beneath the Nile, in the black sections of Africa, there was never, to my knowledge and my research, and I've read a lot of things on it, leftist and rightist, there was never any high civilization other than what the Arab incursions had created in their sojourns into along the African coast. Into the interior, the blacks in Africa lived in a barbaric and a Stone Age state. There were no medicine. There was slavery. In fact, slavery still exists today on the African continent.
Victor, do you want to respond to that? Okay. Well, why don't you respond to David, and then we'll let him have a word, and then you a word, and then we'll move on. Go ahead. Victor, you're on.
That's anti-white, sir. Well, sir,
David,
what you mentioned,
David Duke.
What you mentioned? Can I answer one thing at a time?
All right, Victor, let's let David respond, and then we'll give you the last word, and then we'll move on. David.
Okay. First of all, you said, well, they had knowledge of plants and animals and how to use them, and certain individuals in society did certain things. You can also very easily extrapolate that and use that as an example of an anthill that does not, again, show high culture, technology, civilization, medicine, or anything else. Let me say something here too. I'm not trying to put down the Negroes. You got into this subject, and I'm defending it. What I'm saying, our cultures are different. I like my culture the best. I certainly do. Western civilization, our art, literature, architecture, and way of life. I really prefer.
Do you have black
that.
Friends?
I don't really have any close black friends.
Did you grow up with them?
Yes, I knew some blacks in New Orleans that I was, friendly with. I got along with fine. I know a lot of black people today that I have respect for, and that I can get along with fine. I'd be happy to shake their hand or eat with them or talk with them, and I get along with them perfectly.
How do your fellow Klan members feel about that?
Well, I wouldn't say that I have black. Just like I said, I wouldn't say that I have black friends in the classic sense. I mean, I don't pal around with them or something. But in the course of my work, like I say, I know them and I respect them and I treat them decently. And I don't think any Klansman would oppose that. No, the other thing I want to mention to them is this major point. Okay, you say, okay, it's terrible because we had slavery and so forth, and how was any better not? Well, the point is that we did not get the slaves that were in this country, and I'm not defending slavery, I'm not in favor of it, but we did not get our slaves by going in Africa and rounding them up in the bush, white man. We bought them from other Negroes. They were enslaved when we got them, and they lived in a society in this country that I think was far more advanced. They had better diets, they had better shelter over their heads, they had I think, even more freedom of action than they had in the Stone Age type of society that they lived in Africa.
Victor, you got a closing word? Victor? I think Victor is hung up. Victor already had his last word.
It was best move.
Hello, you're next. Go ahead, Tom. Yes, you're next. Go ahead. Tom, are you there? Yes, speak up.
Yes.
You're on the air. Go ahead, please. Tom, I think you're having a little difficulty hearing what we're saying, so we're going to move on to someone perhaps who will. Hello, you're on the air. Go ahead, please. Are you there? We're either having some problems with our telephones, or no one is listening to when I say hello. Let's go to call number one. Hello, you're on the air. Are you there?
We're losing something here.
We're having problems with our telephone lines. So, Kathy and Chuck, we will let them try to work on our telephone lines. 236-1531. We're having some difficulty, and we will try to solve that, and we'll continue with the picture
that
portion of
blanking.
Our program.
The other one wasn't blanking before.
That's right. Well, we'll see. I would like to get back a little bit, because I heard you tape an interview this afternoon that will air later this weekend. And it seems to me that in the discussion, you mentioned almost nothing about blacks, and your real hang-up, and I will use the word hang-up because it came across that way, is with Jews.
Yeah, I think that's probably right. No, in this respect. When I see our society...
Have they done you wrong somewhere in the past? You know, when people feel the way you feel...
When I was a kid, no Jewish fellow, you know, punched me in the nose or something. Since I've been in this thing, I've had some pretty dirty and rotten things done to me by Zionists and so forth. But I do believe that in this country that the Jews are dominating our media. I mentioned that before. I don't believe the media and the television programming and movie programming reflect the great ideals of our country, our culture, the values that are great for young people to follow and to emulate. I really don't believe that the television has really been a good thing as far as our country goes. And I know these people dominate. The head of ABC is Goldenson, and CBS is Palinsky, NBC is Silverman. You have the programming heads, almost all Jewish, most of the writers and the
and
producers.
You've been on all networks. You have participated in programs.
Not always fairly. A good example is ABC, the Geraldo Rivera, where he just really literally cut up what I did. I told you the PBS network suppressed me. NBC, they had me on there when they thought they were going to be able to put me down, but after they realized that they couldn't do that, I haven't been on back on there in the Tom Snyder Show. And let's see, CBS is the only one. I haven't been on any major talk shows in CBS. I did do a news report with Ed Rabel from Atlanta. We spent 3 days, or almost 4 days, filming this with the national crew. They came down and filmed our rally. They filmed a lot of college students, intelligent people who were joining, a mass rally with thousands of people. They did they were doing a special report on the Ku Klux Klan. And after these 3 days of filming and so forth, they assured me, they promised me it was going to be on. I said, oh, no, it's not going to be any problem and so forth. And it's a very good piece. And they told me it was an excellent piece, a very interesting piece. But it showed the Klan as a lot of intelligent people, a lot of college people at UNO and New Orleans, University of New Orleans, and the program never aired. So I've also experienced suppression at the hands of all three networks. But I'm not really concerned even about the news as much as in the programming. When these subtle things, like Archie Bunker is a good example. They hold up Archie Bunker as a clay pigeon who's supposed to believe in things that I believe in, that the vast numbers of white Americans believe in, then they make him out to be a fool. In other words, they set him up as a clay pigeon, they give him the wrong arguments, their own arguments, then they proceed to cut him down through through his son-in-law or through some other process. We see it constantly, and you can't even hardly watch a comedy program anymore on television not seeing our
race. But if the American people didn't buy it, didn't want to watch it, the show wouldn't have lasted for 9 or 10 years.
Well, I can blame the American people, but where are they going to turn? Do they really have an alternative?
They can turn to two other networks.
Yeah, do they really have...
They can turn to, you know, football or whatever else.
Do they really have an eternity and an alternative in those other two networks? I've been watching so many times on television where you get propaganda in all of them. Another good example of some of the propaganda that I believe has been put out is the Roots Show, which was produced by David Wolper and Freddie Silverman's idea. That was a slap in the face of every white American. There were many white children, elderly people, who suffered from brutality directly because of that program. because they instilled hatred against the white race, and they accused me of being full of hate. I don't believe that, but I think they are. I think Roots was. I'm broadcasting. They, for instance, they made the hero out to be that wrestler, and he's on the slave ship, and the young boy asks him, "What are you going to do?" And he says, "I live to see the white man dead." And this was a hero portrayed to the blacks.
One of the other things that you mentioned in the interview that I heard you do this afternoon was that you made the point about the tremendous contributions that have been made by the whites, and basically saying that very few contributions have been made to mankind by blacks. Now, do you really believe that blacks have made literally no or next to no contributions
to the
growth of society?
They've made next to no contributions, I think, to our society, to our culture. They've made contributions to their own society, and I think they have a right to their own culture. But
and it's all been done
yes,
by
as
whites.
Far as Western civilization goes, okay, as far as the great technological achievements of our society, as far as the great medical achievements, as far as the great works of music, the great works of English literature, for instance.
But in that case,
European
David,
literature.
But in that particular case,
yes,
when you're talking about the whites,
yeah,
it's been made by in a large percentage of the cases, been made by Jews. Now, how do you adjust to that?
There's been a large percentage of cases, They've dominated even our culture in this century. But before this century, no, the Jewish influence was very small in terms of the overriding English literature, for instance, or the overridingness of English or European architecture. Now, I'm not talking about modern society. I don't like modern society.
Well, I mean, but you can't,
I don't like
can you not give them credit in that particular area for the contributions that they have made? What about in the field of medicine? What about Jonas Salk?
Well,
look how many thousands of lives Jonas Salk has saved, and the arts and medicine and a variety of things.
I didn't say the Jews did not make any contributions, and the Jews that have made good contributions, like Jonas Salk, you know, more power to them. That's wonderful. I think it's great, and you know, he's really a good man. He's done great things for our society. Okay, fine, but that's not the point. The point is that our foreign policy now is being dictated, I think, in the Jewish interest rather than the American interest. For instance, in the Middle East, we're paying $200 billion more since the 73 war because of our policy there. We're alienating the Arabs, used to be our best friends. We're pushing the Arabs into the hands of the communists, our worst enemies. We're depleting weapons from Europe, which we need to defend ourselves against communism for Israel. We're spending $3 to $5 billion a year in direct aids, loans, and grants to Israel. In fact, Israel gets half of the foreign aid that this country gives out.
Maybe there's a national morality that we would like to believe in. And that is that we would not like to see the state of Israel, whether they're Israeli or whatever their, you know, religion may be, we don't want to see them massacred. Maybe if we did not try to, you know, maintain a balance in the Middle East, maybe Israel wouldn't be around.
Maybe
they would be dead.
What about the massacres and the wars and so forth that the Israelis have instigated in the Middle East when they settled that state and they've since expanded two times?
They're fighting for their life.
They are fighting because they're taking away other people's lands. They're taking away and the people they've conquered. They've almost got a concentration camp system up there. I've been to Israel. I've seen how these people treat the Arabs. And again, the hypocrisy is incredible. You know, when they talk about civil rights in this country and the way the Jews treat the Arabs in that country. And for instance, let's talk about massacre for instance. The media in this country, whenever they talk about Mock and Begin, they call him a conservative. They might mention in his past, you know, he's a revolutionary at one time. Well, if you think of the Middle East situation, if you would think of the most bloodthirsty terrorist or the terrorist who's committed the most atrocious acts in the Middle East, who would you name? I think very few people would name Menachem Begin, but Menachem Begin was responsible for the massacre at Deir Yassin, where over 256 Arab men, women, and children were murdered, being wiped out specifically to terrorize the Arabs and making them flee their land. He was responsible directly for the blowing up of the King David Hotel in Jerusalem, where over 100 people lost their lives, many women and children included there also. You know, this is not mentioned. There has not the Israeli state shot down a Libyan commercial airliner over the corner
David,
of the occupied.
That's been in the media.
It has not been emphasized in the media. It has not been emphasized.
I mean, to what extent does it have to be emphasized?
Well,
I've read that. I've read it in Time.
Well,
I've read it in
Newsweek. We see endless things about Arab terrorism, but there's no Arab terroristic act like the Munich thing. We saw that for a week. Oh, gosh, we saw that for years. We're still seeing about it. But there's been no Arab terroristic act that can come anywhere close to the Jewish acts of terror. Even recently in Lebanon, when they went in and over 1,000 innocent civilians died. Yeah, some a couple Arab terrorists blew up a school bus, which was terrible, reprehensible, which shouldn't have happened. But then the Israelis go back in and kill 1,000 to 1,100 civilians in Lebanon indiscriminately. So this is not emphasized by our press. So I think not only is our policy bad in terms of our interest, I mean the interest of the majority of the American people, but it's bad in terms, I think, of the basic morality in this thing.
And as far as the American media, you parrot the views of former President Vice President Agnew.
Well, I think he's certainly right. I think maybe that's one of the reasons why the media went against him. Another good example is Fulbright on the leftist side of the spectrum, a liberal. In fact, a person who was very much opposed to the Vietnam War. When he ran for governor in senator in Arkansas during the Vietnam War, he got elected handily. But in 1972 or whatever, 71, he started talking about the tremendous Jewish power. He said that Israel dominated the United States Senate, and tremendous amounts of Jewish money and financial power and so forth poured into Arkansas for Dale Bumpers, who was pro-Zionist, and Bumpers won. These people deal with their enemies. They talk about newspapers that would dare have a line on the Mideast question that would be favorable, you might say, to the Arabs, or in favoring neutrality. I'm not talking about just being a little less for Israel than another paper. I'm talking about favoring neutrality. They destroy. Before World War II, Eugene Meyer got control of the Washington Post that way, the big Jewish advertising in most of your cities that constitute most of the revenue in newspapers. They boycotted the Washington Post because it was anti-interventionist, anti-war. At that time it was a conservative anti-war side. Eugene Meyer later came in and bought the newspaper up for a trifling $600,000, and ever since the Washington Post has been, you know, a liberal outpouring. Same way with the New York Times. The American press in this country is dominated by these people. They're telling us what we shall read, what we shall not read. They're the ones who've lied to us.
How do they do it with Time Life?
How do they do it with Time Life? I don't know. Grunewald's one of the head editors. I don't know.
Well, one of the others. He doesn't call all the shots.
I'll say this.
The major structure of Time Life is not Jewish.
Okay, I'll say this. The two major
papers...
Do you
admit that? The main structure of Time Life, the most probably controlling magazines than any other publisher in the world.
But magazines. The largest newspaper chain in the United States is Sammy Newhouse. Who's Jewish. The two main opinion-forming newspapers in the United States are the New York Times and the Washington Post, which are both Jewish-controlled. They control most of the book publishing in this country. Hollywood, which probably, and television, have more impact on the American people than any other media. And these are almost, you know, these are like a bar mitzvah out there. It's so kosher. It's incredible. But I don't mind. I mean, I think that they should have a right to run their own affairs and work for their own interests. But I think the American people have a right to hear another point of view. But you can't get that. You can't get it. They don't want you to hear the other point of view on race.
But you are getting your point of view, David. You know, again, I'm looking. You've been on Tom Snyder, Lou Gordon, Barbara Walters. I mean, how many millions of people have heard what you had to say? I mean, you're on the radio right now.
You've been
on television. How many TV appearances, radio appearances do you make a year? A couple hundred?
Well, I have made that many.
Well, I mean, that's hardly being shut out.
Mostly
in
local.
It may be that people who believe
in
you.
Let me tell you why. Yeah. Because the media built up the Klan as a boogeyman in the civil rights movement, because they used the Klan in a way to boost civil rights. Because they said, look, the civil rights people got to be great. Because
so
it's
why
horrible.
Do they put you on and let
Wait,
you change
hold.
The image of
so
the Klan?
So it made it newsworthy. It made the Klan newsworthy. And a lot of local people and local TV stations, so forth. First of all, they're not all Jewish. And a lot of them, even who are Jews, are interested in ratings. They're interested in making money. It's not a total control. I never said that. But the thrust of the media, I think you know, and I know, and the people out there listening know, is pro-Zionist, it's pro-integration, it's pro-minority, you know, and the programming and the social novels, you might say, in this country, and the movies and so forth are organized in the same way.
I'd like to talk about, we've got about 8 minutes left. Let's get back to the structure of the Ku Klux Klan now and the growth.
Okay.
Where is it going to be in 10 years, and are you still going to be with it in 10 years?
Well, I believe I shall. I think that the organization is going to be much stronger. It's growing at a very fast pace. And I'm going to be getting more involved in politics. I did run for office. You're right, I did lose. And no matter that I got a fair percentage doesn't make to change the fact that I lost. I did run against a guy who was an incumbent conservative. His wife died the year before, and he was in the prime of life and a big businessman, a member of every civic organization. But I did lose. I'll have to admit that. I got 30%.
You would have been, what, the youngest state senator in Louisiana history?
Right. But I am getting more involved in politics. In 1980, I plan to enter some presidential primaries in the South, and and also in the Midwest, perhaps in Illinois, and we'll have to wait and see.
But what ticket are you going to run on?
Probably going to run as a Democrat. I figure with the Democratic Party, with Carter, Kennedy, and Jerry Brown, that the white voter and the white people of this country aren't going to have much of a choice.
Where are you going to get your money from?
Well, we don't have any large Jewish New York backers like the Democratic and Republican Party. I just read, by the way, I'm not exaggerating, I just read an article in the Wall Street Journal on the financing of the Democratic Party and the financing of the Republican Party. Both the major fundraisers in those parties are Jewish. I don't have any fundraisers like that. I don't have the fundraisers like the NAACP, who has Jewish backing for their legal fund, his push to integration.
George Wallace didn't either.
No. George Wallace ran on very small contributions from a lot of people because he did not have the big money support. He did not have the establishment support.
Have you announced this before, that you're going to run for president?
Actually, I haven't. I've talked about it, but I haven't actually announced it. I'm going to run a number of primaries.
You're announcing today that you're a candidate for president?
Essentially, yeah. Well, I'm not
really?
Making.
You're announcing
not making
it right
a formal
here on this show.
I'm not making a formal announcement.
Well, you can't, because then you're going to run into equal time.
Yeah, but I am going to run in a number of primaries.
You're
going to
run in the 1980 Democratic primary.
Right.
In how many states did you say?
I'm not sure yet.
Illinois.
Protest is an organizational type period, getting issues before the American people, and showing that there's still all opposition in the Democratic Party to these liberal anti-white programs they're engaging in. But I see things more of a potential, more possibility for actual victory in 1984. But I'm definitely going to enter some primaries in 1980.
So you think that you could win in 1984?
1984. I figure 1988. I'm going to make it one way or the other.
You're going to keep going. In other words, you're the new George Wallace of the 80s.
Oh, don't put it that way, please.
You're speaking to the same fears and concerns that George Wallace spoke to, and you're 28 years old.
Maybe legitimate concerns, but the thing is, I think I'm a lot more honest than George Wallace. George Wallace would not say race. You know, he would talk ways and sentences and structures that would indicate he believed in race. He'd use key words or suggestive words.
He mellowed.
Well, he did a lot. I think that he pretty basically ran out in his philosophy. I don't know whether it was because of his shooting or whether I don't know what all the factors were. I'm starting out different than he is, and that I'm just telling the whole truth. I'm mentioning the Jewish power in this country, which everybody's afraid to do. Very few politicians will do. A lot of people know about it. I'm mentioning the race issue, which a lot of people know about but are also afraid to mention.
You say that a lot of people in the country feel the way that you feel. A lot of people who speak out on controversial subjects, they never reach their goal because they say things that a lot of people don't like. John Kennedy said things that people didn't like. Robert Kennedy did. George Wallace did. Martin Luther King did. Do you fear that if you enter the political arena that maybe you won't last very long?
Well, I don't see how it can be much more dangerous than what I do now. I mean, the communists put out publications where they say to kill me. I just feel a duty, a responsibility, and perhaps maybe I can't live the way I want to this way, or maybe I won't even live that long this way, but at least I'm doing what I believe in, and somebody's got to. I'm really concerned. I'm really concerned about these students in these schools. I don't see anybody. The NAACP is concerned about the black students, but I don't see anybody really concerned about the poor whites that are shipping to black ghettos.
How does your wife and daughter feel about what you do and the security situation that you have wherever you go?
Well, I think the people that are close to me are certainly concerned about my safety. My parents are certainly concerned.
Are they embarrassed?
They accept it.
Are they embarrassed when they read some of the articles that have been written about you and some of the things that you say?
I think they're especially embarrassed when they read some of the lies and misrepresentations that have been written. But I guess in some ways they may feel some parental pride, at least the knowledge that their son is acting upon his conscience and doing what he believes to be right and just.
Your father works for the government.
He's an engineer.
Who works for the government?
Yeah.
You mentioned to me today that you felt that if it ever became known, that he might get fired. Does no one know that?
Well, I'm sure a few people that he knows know, but But I'm concerned about that. I don't see why my career or my activities or my political beliefs should affect him and his career and what he does. And so
wouldn't it be relatively easy, though, for I want to say a third-rate investigative journalist or an agency of the government to very easily find out who your father is, where he works, and get him fired? Wouldn't that cause you a lot of personal consternation? That is one of the reasons we might say that, alluding to the book, that Patsy Sims has written called The Klan. I mean, there appears to be certain things about your current existence that would indicate that maybe you do have some assistance from the United States government.
Why should he be fired? I mean, you've got to have some justification. I mean, you can't go fire.
But they can find that easily.
You can't go fire somebody just because of what his son does. And I think that would be, he's got a good record. I mean, he's 66 years old. He's got a very...
But if it were in the paper, he would be ridiculed.
Well, it's been in the paper before. He shouldn't be. And I think there are some people, maybe some people in government that are just, I don't know if everybody is a total rat. Most of the politicians are. but I'm going to stand up. You know, we've got a future of our race to consider and the future of our blood in this planet and our beliefs. And I'm going to fight as hard as I can, as long as I can. And by the way, anybody who doubts me can write me. David Duke, Jefferson, Louisiana. The zip code is 70181. David Duke, Jefferson, Louisiana. Competing against the music here. David Duke, Jefferson, Louisiana. Zip code is 70181. I'll send him a free copy of our newspaper.
David Duke has been our guest, Grand Wizard of the Knights of the Ku Klux Klan. Thank you very much. I'm sorry for all the technical problems we had this evening. Next week, I am very sure that we will not have these same technical difficulties. I'm Bruce Dumont. We'll see you next Thursday night, 7 o'clock. So long, everybody.
The preceding program was made possible through a grant from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
National Public Radio, WBEZ, Chicago.